Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, if you were hoping for the two-headed monstrosity jubbery, sorry, you get this two-headed monstrosity with two-headed and two-bodied monstrosity.
Well, speaking of monstrosities, Justin Robert Young.
Hey, it's me.
Gentlemen, I don't know if you heard this, but Kickstarter had a little bit of a announcement they made, and let me get the...
I've not heard this.
Oh, no. It's, you know, as they say in the industry, you know, you want to be on the lookout for the drip, drip, drip stories.
So, yeah, Kickstarter is launching its own version of Patreon.
Huh.
Drip. Justin, you want to explain this?
Well, I'll tell you what, I actually have not kind of gone in depth with it, but from what I know, this is a service that existed before that they acquired. They did not change the name, which I think might ultimately be a mistake. But effectively, look, Patreon has changed a lot, you know, in terms of how people make money, and Kickstarter was obviously the closest comp to it. It makes sense for them to get into it. I think that it is better for the landscape for there to be a more ways to monetize your audience that are not your platform, as many people on YouTube and I'm sure, you know, Twitch and stuff are not going to be immune to hard business decisions being made. But this will provide integration. If you launch a Kickstarter and then you want to fund it in a way that isn't a Kickstarter, then you can go ahead and do that. But I don't know if there's anything else that I'm missing here that differentiates it from Patreon.
One of the things that they were talking about as a differentiating feature was being able to export your drip data, because Kickstarter is set up as one of those public benefits companies, so that part of their action is that they can do things that are good for the culture rather than just benefactors or their investors. And so I think a big part that they're trying to sell is that you can take this data elsewhere.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's Bryce Castillo, by the way, is actually the fourth member and the most important one of After Things and Weird Things. I like it's funny because, like, I know I'm getting old when, you know, you click through on some of these, like, you know, very social media engaged sort of stuff, and they show, like, you know, creative, youthful people doing stuff. And I go to Drip, and a new tool for creators by Kickstarters. And you see a photo of people that, like, is this a new X-Men team?
Yeah, it does. It does look like an X-Men team. Like,
I know I'm old when, you know, yeah. Like, okay.
Is this a Die Antwood, the next generation?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, just like, I'm out of touch. But it's a very, very exciting time. And I was thinking about kind of our theme is, you know, we've been at the Justin and I have been podcasting for 11 years now, right? Wow. Since we started our first podcast. Brian's been in it. How long have you been doing Scam School, Brian?
Scam School, I had the idea and started pitching 10 years ago this month. I think 10 years ago at this moment, I was planning... I was getting ready to come shoot the pilot.
But even then, before that, for BB on the road, right? Nope.
Yeah. I guess Brian Brushwood on the road was, 11 years. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, 2006.
I think, you know, we're used to the idea now that sometimes things are, some ideas aren't necessarily radically, oh my God, that's a brilliant new idea. It's the implementation. Certain kinds of technology make it easier to implement. You know, Uber is a fascinating company. Uber is worth something like $60 billion. There is nothing really inherent about Uber that could not have existed 10 years before Uber came out. You could have had in 1996, you know, short text, you know, your address, the street address of where you're at, whatever, and we'll come pick you up or something. You know, there could have been a version of that. And there are things that just made it more possible. Cell phones in the hands of all the drivers, GPS stuff, all these sort of things that sort of all came together. Crowdfunding, things like this. In the 90s, there was a lot of talk about the idea of escrow-based funding for stuff. This was something I talked about because the idea of like, hey, like, you know, we're still going to see forms of this. Like, there is going to be a new Star Wars film. I don't know if you guys heard. And it's like, all you have to tell me is new Marvel movie. And I'm like, great, I'll pay my money now. Don't tell me anything about it. I don't care. I'm there. You know, if I go to two in a row that suck, then I won't be there. But I'm not worried about that. And that opens up the idea of, you know, the idea of like thinking like, where are we going to be 10 years from now in crowdfunding and creator funding? I think that we're already seeing, like, you take Brian is a production company. Brian really is a production company. You produce multiple shows. Mm-hmm. You have your own branding. You have your own advertising, et cetera, things like this. What we need, in my opinion, are tools or frameworks to be able to say, this is really what you do and how you function, to say like, okay, is there a tool that can make it easier to do subscription-based sort of content for you or whatever? Are there ways in which you can make it easier for people to say, oh yeah, I want to pay X amount of dollars a month for this, like Patreon does, but different, or for bigger scale stuff? And I think that we're going to evolve towards there. I don't think anybody really knows what that should be because we don't quite know enough about how people behave, but I'm excited to see that Kickstarter's taking this seriously because, you know, this is the direction we're going into. And if there were better tools out there, we would get there faster.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's one of the, there's a weird kind of blowback. We did a Modern Rogue update video where we broke down, we tried to do full transparency. We broke down all the numbers, both in the amount of footage that we've shot, where it's allocated, what types of episodes we made, how much money we've taken in, and how much of that is Patreon's cut. And I was really surprised by the number of comments from people who were just mad that Patreon got 5%. They're just irrationally angry about that thought. And I was like, well, understand, they have an ecosystem, a marketplace. They have fantastic cross-promotional tools. They bring us discovery. They make it easy. They provide a service. And I think a 5% fee is eminently reasonable for it. But I don't know. Do you think that people are going to stay that ignorant, for lack of a better word? Or do you think?
Yes.
Really?
I mean, it's credit card fees. I mean, you know, there is just an element of how money gets moved that people fundamentally don't either don't understand or don't want to understand.
You have, you know, we see an example of this in the box office. And, you know, I read this post about, you know, Tom Green explaining why Freddy Got Fingered was actually a box office success. And he's like, made $18 million and the budget was $18 million. It's like, okay, what was the studio's cut? You know, what was this cut? And even people inside the business that look at these numbers, then you look at like now where everybody's studying, you know, Justice League, because, you know, this is, you know, the same studio that gave us, you know, Wonder Woman, an amazing, you know, really, really fun film. You know, we get Justice League, which opens lower than the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie. And you hear me like, I made $94 million. It's like, it's not what the studio gets, you know, and, you know, add in what it'll, you know, the studio gets something like half of that. And then internationally, like, made it back internationally. Like, no, it gets a 25% to 30%. We've been around this for years and people still don't understand, you know, how that works, you know?
Yeah. I think it's, so back to kind of the big picture. I love the fact that they are introducing another competitor in this space. I love the fact that it's normalizing this as an idea. You know, Kickstarter sounded outrageous at the time it first busted on the scene.
E-begging.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And yet look at how many really great projects have come as a result of the Kickstarter dynamic. And same thing with Patreon. I think more people are accustomed to the idea of being middle-class patrons. You know, it's like it used to be, you had to be the richest of the rich to announce loudly, I like this art, I want to make it happen. And now that's no longer the case. Now anyone can get that confidence. The jokester in me wants to call it the smug superiority, but it's more than that. It's like, you know, you get an emotional benefit when you become a patron of something, and the more different takes that we see. Do we know how drip really differs from patronage on Patreon?
Not a clue.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what the cut difference is.
Right now, it's instant invite only, and so only like a handful of creators who have made Kickstarters in the past, super successful ones, have access to drip.
Yeah,
they have to do that kind of slow roll. The key is to do that rollout in a way that doesn't annoy people. Like, I'm aware of another company that's doing kind of their own influencer rollout, and it's the most offensive thing in the world if you're not, you know, cool enough to be that, you know. And that's, you know, you get into these sort of, you know, I deal with. If we talk, you know, we as being people who do things online, the internet, in front of other people, we get approached by people all the time, and there's this amazing kiss ass sort of industry of people who approach you because, oh, you're an influencer and stuff. And it's like, I don't know. We could do a whole nother episode about that, about how, yeah, if you have a certain number of Twitter followers and you complain about something, yeah, you'll get treated better than we didn't have that many Twitter followers. And this. Not a lot of people complain about that. You know?
A friend of mine is getting ready to release his book, Nate Staniforth. Yeah. You were kind enough to give a very generous quote praising Nate's work, and we love his stuff. It's been amazing to watch him agonize over writing his book, and trust me, you're going to hear me talk a lot about it over the next 2 months. But he's got a January release. And he's very in tune with the idea that there is a number, there is a specific target number that if you hit that number, the odds are very good that you will show up on the New York Times bestseller list. And as he's going in to promote, you know, he's hitting up a bunch of people for quotes and you know, that stuff. But as we have been planning how to promote his book on the Scam School channel and help get the word out on it. You know, there's this dawning realization that he said, wow, it seems like, you know, how good the book actually is way less important than the currency of attention. Like, that's the most valuable thing you can have, is the attention of other people. And I brought up to him the Tim Wu book, The Attention Merchants, which, you know, that's the whole thesis about that as well. And I think it really does speak to the power of platforms, and no matter what you're doing, to have some ability to reach people so that, you know, when you have your billion-dollar idea, you can at least get the avalanche started. You can get the snowball beginning.
I fundamentally believe that the quality of your project is always most reflected on the next project, like not that project. So if you are selling that book, then sure. I mean, for it to have a long tail because a book's something that is going to come out immediately after they buy it, and people are going to be able to read it really fast, and they're going to be able to rate it at a certain speed, then absolutely. But in general, I think that your real value of putting the effort and quality into it is going to be when you do something again, and now you have that reputation where that brush fire is able to spread that much faster because people are primed.
We're definitely seeing that with this year's the puzzle box that we're doing this year. We did a red variant on the Outlaws deck of cards, and then the puzzle box we did is one called the Outlaws Vault, and I have been on pins and needles because the one thing I can't know is how it will be received by people who want to enjoy it. And I knew that this was the most challenging puzzle box we've done, but I didn't know if that would be something that would make people happy or not. And the first 144 have gone out, and now am I seeing on Twitter, you know, the joy of successfully opening it, as people send me pictures of their challenge coins and talk about, you know, how much they enjoyed the difficulty of it. It's terrifying to just be on pins and needles, not knowing how your thing's going to be received.
I'm going to add, though, to it, like, yes, having a big social media influence can help a book pop a New York Times bestseller list. But I would say the influence of that list has declined tremendously. It absolutely has value. It's declined tremendously. And one of the things that the publishing industry still doesn't quite grasp or understand is that I can have a book that is been out for the way the publishing industry works. There was this court case years ago, and what the court case basically had to do with this like machine tool and die company. It said that you can't, like, the way you had to handle, like, you had to depreciate your losses or whatever, and, like, you couldn't count them as, like, you know, lost profit or whatever. You had to depreciate the value, whatever. The short result was publishing companies are in a hurry to pulp whatever books they don't sell, right? They decided that after that, like, if we don't sell X number in the first 2 weeks or first three months, then we'll just get rid of all the other ones. And so you won't have these books around to buy anymore, meaning that you can't have, let's say there was a resurgence in one of your titles, you have to sell thousands in order for the publisher to go back and say, let's go do a reprint. They're not going to, if you're selling, you know, 20 or 30 a week, they won't reprint that book, even if that means that over the course of a year, you're going to sell 1,000 or more copies of that book, which would be profitable. So the publishing industry got in this very funky way of doing things that made it very hard for things that weren't big hits initially to stick around and keep making revenue. Kindle and EPUB changed that. Now they changed that. So you take a book like I have, The Naturalist, okay? Or excuse me, The Naturalist comes out, and I have a big pop. That book does fantastic. It does amazing, et cetera. There may be a press announcement about that soon. We did officially announce, by the way, that there are two more books coming that I'll be doing two more with my publisher on that. So that series is continuing. And there's probably maybe another announcement we're waiting about.
Is that two more on top of the second one that was already announced?
Yeah, there'll be four books total so far. Yeah.
Dude, that's great.
But Station Breaker, which is an indie book I published last year on my own, I've had slow but steady sales for that book consistently, right? Now, if we added all of the sales I've had of that book in its entirety, you know, and we put that into the normal window at which, you know, it's outsold your average published novel. It's outsold the average novel, average sci-fi novel that a publisher puts out there. But it's just been, you know, 10 copies this week, 20 copies this week over time. And it's a different world. So they don't have a way to measure that. How do you measure? Like, I know what the total sales of that book are. And when I go to publishers, they'll say, hey, this book sold this many copies. They'll go, oh, there's been a continued interest for it because it's digital or it's on demand. And so I'd say that, you know, to Nate's thing, like, yes, that initial pop helps. But if you have a book that's a good book that continues to get recommended and bought, you will see a year later, a couple years later, you'll see, man, I'm still making money from this book because it's still getting recommended by people and it's still in the recommendation, you know, algorithms. And so I'm just looking something up like, yeah, like I would have, had I done Station Breaker with a traditional publisher, I would have way out earned whatever advance they would have given me, you know, but I keep all that profits myself. So we are in a different age. If you play the game your own way, you can do really well.
Yeah, well, and I think part of the reason that you're enjoying so much success is that you have a very heterogeneous approach to it. You know, some of your stuff is traditional publishing, some of it's indie, you know, all ebook publishing. You've got properties, and I guess I'm in the same thing as well. In that, you know, I guess both of us have done television projects that are owned by bigger entities, and then also. You know, the independent projects like the Modern Rogue, I don't know, trying a bunch of different approaches seems to have worked pretty well for us.
Yeah, you know, people get into this mindset and we talk about this again, but it's worth harping on is, you know, people say, oh, I just want to write. I want somebody else to handle this. You know, like, oh, great.
Crush that mentality. Destroy that thought out of your mind. You do not get to play in a sandbox and be a beautiful artist that everybody comes and gawks and throws money at. That is a fairy tale, and it's damaging for you to believe that that's even a possibility.
And you will see occasionally, you'll see sometimes actors or artists who do get into that, oh, they have other people that handle everything. What happens? They overspend, outspend.
They're gone.
Who knew? Who knew that he was quietly embezzling and spending this money on posters that his brother owns the print shop for and so on?
Yep. And, you know, what it comes down to is you say, oh, I don't want to have to worry about it. Fine. Then have a day job. You know, have a day job and create for fun. And yes, you get to do that. But if you say, I don't want to do the work, you know, and that's what I hear, like, I don't want to do the work. I don't want to do the work. And you're like, well, that's nice to have a dream. And I've said this before, but the difference between Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and most everybody else is the day they became billionaires, they still showed up at work.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You know, the plan was I'm making a billion and I exit. No, the plan was something bigger and more dramatic. So I think that I'm excited about where this is going and that I think that if you have people who are putting out, you know, quality stuff. We've seen opportunistic sort of things like, oh, we'll go to these YouTube celebrities, whatever, and we'll make a movie or we'll do this, whatever. And maybe they're trying to capitalize on, you know, the idea they had an audience, not necessarily on the idea that they were doing really good stuff. But crowdfunding is exciting. I think we're going to start seeing, we've seen movie crowdfunded movie studios and other things like this that kind of had, maybe that they weren't, you know, most of those initiatives weren't led by people where we knew about the quality of their work. But I think that we're going to start, you know, I mean, Kevin Smith has done some neat stuff with Red State, things like this. And I think that, you know, I love to watch him speak. I'm not so much into where his films are now, but I think we're going to start seeing just more of that. Just, you know, more, you know, hard to describe, but like the idea of, you know, when you had a guy like, you know, we got Dr. Horrible and that kind of stuff. And that, and I think we just need better tools and ways to put those things out there.
And I think that, again, I cannot redline as important enough the idea of non-platform tied funding. You know, YouTube announced last week that they were going to try to create non-advertising revenue streams for some of the people that are upset with how they've changed the monetization process. And effectively to me, I mean, I'd be curious your point of view on this, Brian, but like I read that as, yeah, this is the new normal for ad stuff and there's no way that we're going to fix it, which I think for some people is kind of disheartening.
Yeah. Well, luckily, as we built the Modern Rogue, we never leaned entirely on YouTube ad revenues. And as a result, we always treated it with suspicion. And don't get me wrong, it's an important leg of the platform that helps make it possible for us to, you know, hit that level of production quality and timeliness. But, you know, it's always been a mixture of that and Patreon and occasional integrated ads. And then whatever, now that we just launched the Modern Rogue store, that will help out as well.
I'm going to throw something out here, too. It's like, so my friend and I, we wanted to watch The Player, right? You know, the Robert Altman movie starring Tim Robbins. And I could buy it for like $20. But then I look and there's like Filmstruck has the Criterion subscription for like $8 a month, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, $8, you know, $8. I'll pay the $8, watch it. And if I find more content on there, I'll keep doing it. I subscribe to BritBox for like $6, $7, whatever. And, you know, I'm like, I'll just watch Red Dwarf. Red Dwarf ended, you know what? I'll watch these Doctor Who. And if I'm paying $7, I'll do that. I've had other subscriptions that I paid for, like for watching like old MST3K. And I've said this before. I think that would be a great evolution would be a standalone separate from Patreon rather than get dinged all at once for everything you subscribe to is to have to separate and to parcel that out because not all Patreon content is the same or whatever. I would love to see a model like that because I have no trouble like, you know, if like, hey, if somebody said, hey, Andrew, would you want to buy the Schwood channel as a separate sort of $5 a month thing? And then it's pops up like, you know, app. And there are people who've tried versions of this. I get that. But I would be really, really into that, like treating that like a discrete kind of product. You know, imagine if everything you bought on Amazon product wise, you got one big, huge bill at the month outside of your credit card bill. But like, you'd be like, oh, I've been spending way too much on Amazon. I can't do this, you know, or even iTunes, you know. And I like the idea of creating we'll let you do your own separate billing for your service, because that way people aren't getting sticker shock when they're like, I'm spending this much on Patreon.
Yeah. I don't know. That's one of the most delightful surprises to me has been the reaction to, you know, you get sticker shock, you know, you make promises. And then at the beginning of the month, it's Patreon day. And all of a sudden you get dinged for $50 of promises that you had made or whatever. And like this has become a ritual where it's like this is the time where I thank everyone on Twitter and talk about how you guys have changed my life, maybe because, you know, made it possible for me to stop constantly touring on the road and all that stuff. And in return, the thing that makes me so happy is the responses are all universally like, oh, I love it. It's the day I feel like I'm doing a good thing for the arts. I feel like I, you know, like it's a two-way street. You know, obviously, you know, the performer enjoys the benefit of being able to keep the lights on, but I think that there's a psychic benefit to the patrons who know that they are making a difference in their favorite art.
So I think, Andrew, your idea is great, and I would love it if every month there wasn't this like, all right, well, now let me see how much I love each and every one of these Patreon donations I'm doing so I can revise it down back to a number that I'm cool with. However, I do think that that idea can only really happen in a world post-Patreon but the biggest important thing that Patreon did was establish it as a bank, like a financial institution that you don't care if you give them your credit card. You know that it has the brand of this is where you support people. You know when every podcast or YouTube that you say says, hey, support my Patreon, they don't need to go through the whole spiel of exactly what it is. That brand is so important that I would love, now that we are there, that we could kind of try some of the things that were, tried before, maybe weren't as successful, which is like, yeah, no, here, piecemeal though. And like, maybe you get this channel. Bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you get this bill. Maybe it's like, oh no, of course I pay $10 for Jury, right? Or I pay, $5 for Modern Rogue. That's cool. Of course. Yeah. It's just not like, oh my God, $100? Jesus.
I think that from a psychological point of view, because some things are radically different in the sort of services you provide. So if I'm supporting a comic book illustrator on Patreon, to lump that in with my podcast and everything else I support, whatever. Just a thought that of like, oh, going to that sort of like, because then allows you to create sort of different sort of products too that you do, But anyhow, I'm excited by where this is going though. I'm excited by where this is going. And you could see like, oh, we could do a, we're going to do Weird Things Films. What does that mean? Oh, well, $5 is going to give you access to all of our shows. Plus, we're going to make, two or three feature films a year when we get to this level, and like, oh, studios, that's kind of a neat idea,
Yeah.
But anyhow, predictions for 2027.
Oh, man. Specifically in the landscape of crowdfunding?
Yeah, and I'm telling you, it's one hand, it sounds crazy to say that, but that's a shorter amount of time than we've been doing this podcasting and we've been doing this thing.
You know what? Here's something that does not exist, but I think will. And maybe it'll be a feature that Patreon starts doing or someone like that. But basically, I think we're going to become more comfortable with having our attention tracked. And so basically a service that says, hey, you know what you love, just for $20 a month, we will watch how much you watch the things and watch what you clearly love more than other stuff. And we will apportion your $20 a month appropriately to all the creators of independent stuff that you watch. I think what we fear in Patreon is making a promise and getting stuck behind it. Cause once you get that credit card, you're like, well, I guess this is just going to be forever. And that's fine, but I would love if there was something that would help me be more judicious and nuanced where my donations went than the brute force attack of me trying to guess what future me will enjoy in the future. Does that make sense? Like, I don't want to have to log in and manage and be thinking about how much do I love X, Y, or Z or whatever. I would love it if that could be outsourced by somebody just watching my viewing behavior and saying, clearly you dig this, so we've given the money appropriately.
Like an entity that says we're going to have a slate of content you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, we're describing a cable company, right?
No.
but I've kind of come back to seeing the benefits of a cable all-in-one subscription stuff, the all-you-can-eat buffet.
Oh, my God, cord killers. Either you die a hero or live long to see yourself become the villain.
Exactly, right?
Well, yeah, I think there is the problem we've long had in television is that, in broadcast television, it's not unlike Facebook or Google where we're the product. We're being sold to advertisers. When you're not paying for the content, then you're getting content that somebody else is paying for you to see, which is either to entertain you and get you to watch ads or to get you to do something. And that's the thing, the trade-off we have to realize is that when you use Facebook, there's a reason Facebook provides this amazing service for you for free, because that time you spend on there is very valuable to them because they can influence your decisions overtly and subtly, ways in which you don't think about. And when it comes to content stuff, I love, like, I love Netflix because I pay them a fee. They try to entertain me. They don't put ads. They try to entertain me. And if they don't like, if I don't like it, if there's enough stuff I just don't like, then I stop paying them, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a pretty straight transaction versus anyhow. But yeah, I know what you're saying. I think that there is that curation and all that, is this curation to really try to do that. It's interesting. Have you played around with the Apple's TV program?
Mm-mm.
Take a look at that, because what Apple's trying to do is the TV app and on the Apple TV and the iPhone is it will track the things that you watch through there that you're watching, and then it will make recommendations based on this. And it is whatever you have subscriptions to, it'll tell you like, oh, check this out. Here's a playlist for you. You might want to check this thing out over here or whatever. And it's really a clever thing that I think the problem is it's not obvious, and it's a little bit, you know, kind of maybe not as implemented as well as it can. But I've had, you know, a number of times I go in there and it's like, oh, we put together a playlist or whatever based upon these other shows you've watched. And if you're trying to find something, it'll tell you where you can watch this. And so anyhow, I have enjoying that.
So what about you? You got a prediction for 2027?
My prediction is I think we're going to have better tools for creating. There's a lot of stuff that's just making this show happen is hard. And when I say it's hard, I mean Bryce has to do a lot of work.
We're not saying who it's hard for, but it's hard somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
and then periodically I'll look and I'll be like, oh, I didn't get an option payment or a publisher's payment when I want. And Brian gets a text message from me like, hey, Bryce, time to divvy up that money. You know, there's the financial tools managers, the financial management side of it. And I enjoy creating. Like, I've been off and on doing my Magic Club podcast, which I enjoy doing the podcast. All of the work around it, the editing and everything else like that, is a pain. And so much of that could be automated. There's so many things. There are so many tools that we thought that people would be creating for podcasting 10 years ago that are not even around now. And just some people are starting to create versions of that. And part of me is like, man, should I just sit down to like make some of the stuff? Because I've been frustrated by like, no, I think there's a really big market for it if you understand what the whole problem is. But a lot of the tools and stuff the tech industry come out with are designed to solve the problems for people in that side of it. When it comes to artistic tools, there are not enough artists creating apps. I would say that's a problem. But I think so 10 years from now, I think that we're going to have much better tools for creation. I think we're going to have much better tools and analytics for really understanding what people like or what they don't like. I think the tools for collaboration are going to get better. And I think we're going to continuously watch. You watch the quality of a lot of YouTube shows now. It's better than better than cable television in many cases, better than a lot of stuff you see that, you know, you go watch a cable channel and you watch some of these channels like, wow, like I see better stuff on YouTube now because quality people are making it and the quality rises. You know, there's a crap problem, and that's the problem of like there's been a big crackdown on these, you know, these videos designed for kids keyword searches. Mm-hmm. You know, you ever type in like Joker Spider-Man into like YouTube and see what comes up?
No.
Well, no, there's the whole like what is it? Elsa Spider-Man, that's like just like this huge gigantic YouTube channel, and it's just these two weirdos like rolling around and Elsa and Spider-Man costumes.
Yeah, you'll like shot literally in somebody's back patio. You'll have like two kids in Spider-Man costumes driving cars, pulling up to a window of the back door, and somebody in a Hulk costume giving them McDonald's.
And then that's the video.
Yeah, like that. 10 minutes of this sort of stuff, and it is. You know, there's some people just outrage over it. I'm like, I think some of the outrage is a little bit. All right, this is dumb, but I mean,
I'll tell you what, man. You know, ultimately, what I care about is that my kids shut up and watch this, you know, and I don't really care how good or bad the quality of that content is, well, as long as it doesn't lead to awkward questions.
As far as the content of some of these, like what are being kind of these vilified YouTube channels, I think some of them rightfully so, because some of it's like, I don't know, like, you know, a father terrorizing his daughter after she's lost a tooth. But the ones where they have like just, you know, licensed characters that are not being licensed, you know, in somebody's backyard, you know, at a not really a Burger King being fed by the Hulk. Yeah, I don't know that they're any worse than Teletubbies, you know, and, you know, Brian's point of like, I just want my kids to shut up.
I meant that in the most loving way a father can, by the way.
In Brian's statement of, I want my kids to find other forms of stimulation besides just looking inwards towards the family, looking to the world around them for things in which they can be enriched. I think that, you know, yeah, like I look at this and I get why it's like, it's just like people driving, kids driving in Spider-Man costumes, driving little electric go-karts around and being chased by a Hulk police officer. It makes no sense. It's like, I got news for you. Most children's content at a certain point makes no sense. And when we decided to make the TV the babysitter, every screen became a babysitter.
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, there's a reason why kids programming leaves like half of their runtime so kids can yell back at the television, right? Like, it's just like all the preschool stuff is all like, I'm going to do a thing, right? Am I?
Yes, do the thing.
Yep. Maybe that's how we can change after things, make it that format. We can do one third the work. I'm going to make a YouTube channel. Should I?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I did.
Hooray.
All right. I will.
I'm excited. I think that what we need, though, is I think more artists need to be making tools. I think that's what Patreon came from, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, it was Jack Conte from Poplamoose, you know, wanting to figure out a new way to monetize their channel. And, you know, this is something that I've had conversations with people. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but I'll just say in general. But, like, I've had conversations with people at Twitch and you know, there were some people that were like, hey, look, we can do better. We can do better. There's no reason why people should be giving money to Patreon when they can be giving money through Twitch. And it's like, yes, and you should always be looking to make reasons why your platform should reward people giving money through your platform. But the one thing the Patreon and Drip and everything else will always have is they're not you. And you can change ownership. And you can change leadership. And you can make decisions that now mean the money that is coming from you is either less, more, or different. What the off-platform solution can say is, we're not that. And you're less likely to be able to say, like, if they're like, all right, well, I mean, sure. But if Patreon got sold to Amazon or something else tomorrow and now was looking to monetize in a different way, then maybe we would be wary about them too. But for right now, they're great because they're the bank and they're not where I make my money otherwise.
I'm going to give you kind of an interesting sort of story is that you take like online payments or payment services in general. PayPal was at the forefront, obviously. Hey, the internet, people are going to want to buy things on the internet. And when PayPal started, there was still the argument like, we think it's a niche thing. It's the internet's just sort of an electronic catalog kind of thing. People want to go to stores and feel goods and do this sort of stuff. You know, this is what people convinced themselves and told themselves. And I have numerous examples. At some point, I have examples of talking to execs within a company, very, very big media company, and listening to them explain to me like, oh, yeah, no, well, we're not worried about this thing at all because the numbers are really this. And now they're in complete panic mode 2 years later because I'm at like, what about this? Oh, no, no. And then, but anyhow, PayPal, great example of like, hey, we think that online people buying things online, probably a big thing. And they had to fight and work hard. It wasn't like, hey, we have the solution. Everybody's like, oh, thank goodness. Finally, they had to fight to make that a reality. Another company a decade later, which was Square. Square says, hey, you know, trying to get a credit card terminal or to do credit card transactions, even in real physical space, is still a pain. It's still a challenge. It's still not that easy to do it. And Square is like, you know, every phone, every smartphone has a connection to the internet. We put a little dongle in there and you could swipe a credit card. And it was one of these things like, there's got to be reasons why nobody's done that. No, the reason's often that nobody tried to make it work, or somebody did it and didn't have quite the right solution, or the other elements weren't there. Square came out, you know, Square launched as a company, and Square came up with this very easy sort of thing to do. And you know, when you got a Square, you know, device, you knew it as sort of that dongle, which was, it was a technological solution, which wasn't like, you know, wasn't the most super genius, innovative one, but it was still it did exactly what it needed to do. And, you know, Square was started by Jack Dorsey, one of the founders of Jack Dorsey, one of the founders of Square, one of the founders of Twitter. Square just passed Twitter in stock market value. and they solved a problem that people went like, ah, it's a tiny little, is it really that big of a deal? Is it really that hard to get a credit card terminal? Is it really hard to do this? How many times have you walked on into a business now and you paid via Square?
100%. Yeah. No, it's huge. I mean, I was just at PAX Unplugged, and that was the way that that ran. If you're a merchant, you had a Square terminal.
And so often it's these tools that are just slightly better than everything else, but you get rid of that little bit of friction and you don't realize there's a lot of little points of friction to getting something done. And that can be applied to podcasting, Patreon solved, because you could say Patreon, well, why don't you just have a PayPal buy button, you know, that people click every month, or a subscription thing. Why don't you just do a YouTube, you know, or PayPal subscription button? They have those. And that was an argument. People were like, you just have this thing and it's the same thing. And you sometimes have to go like, no, there's a reason why. And it's not that people don't want to subscribe to stuff. It's just that the fulfillment, there's a lot more little speed bumps there than people realize. And sometimes it's not the big leap. It's getting rid of a few of those little bumps, and then it's easy. So
you got any picks? I'll go first. I watched this last night. Based on Justin's recommendation, I canceled my Sling account, which they made very easy to do, but I still had a few days left on it. So I was able to use Sling to authenticate and let me watch the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary on Ric Flair, the Nature Boy, and it was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, he's kind of a piece of garbage, huh?
but lovable. But also, I can't imagine the pain of what he's gone through, losing a son like that. And
I mean, without getting too far into it, that is the dichotomy of Ric Flair. Is like you almost feel guilty for liking him so much, you know. Specifically when you get into it, but I thought it was a good job. I'm gonna call my own number here, guys. I gave a talk over the weekend.
How did that go?
It went great. You can see it at bit.ly/ksmoney, all lowercase. I made a little bit.ly for it. bit.ly/ksmoney. How to lose $40,000 on Kickstarter. John and I gave the talk at PAX Unplugged in Philadelphia this weekend, and it went great. I was super, super happy to be a part of PAX programming for the first time, and this was a great crowd for this kind of talk. We were thrilled to give it. If you want to listen to the mistakes we made in terms of losing $40,000 on Kickstarter, it is not what I think a lot of people assume, which is just budgeting problems. We actually budgeted the project perfectly. We wound up kind of succumbing to a little bit of overactive enthusiasm. And then everything we did to crawl our way out of debt is also part of it. So surprise, there is a happy ending. But go ahead and check it out. That is bit.ly/ksmoney.
So I've been using the iPhone 10 now for a couple weeks. Love it. Really, really enjoy it. And I'm excited. I was at a party last night, and I was showing a friend, like, they were playing with video equipment. I made a quick video using the 4K 24 frame per second, which cool, looks cinematic. And my friend's like, oh, okay, iPhone has cool cameras. I'm like, no, actually, like, the latest, like, Samsung phone has probably even better video. You know, like, it's great. They're all getting great. You know, they're all cool. You know, and that's what I love, is they're all doing awesome things. One of my favorite apps is Clips, which, talk about making things easier to do. Clips has been an app that Apple came out with to make it very easy to create quick little videos and stuff. And one of the things they've integrated now into Clips is using that augmented reality, the AR kit. So when you, if you want to have a background, the background moves with you. And I'm going to show you a quick video I made.
Hey, look who I found. Oh, nice. So for those of you just listening, it is Andrew looking like a hologram on the Millennium Falcon, and behind him is indeed the Millennium Falcon.
So what happens is you spin as you film yourself, and you move the camera. If you move your camera around you, it adjusts the background accordingly. So you have a virtual set using, it uses the front camera that's got the depth field. So it's got the 3D, you know, the lens, the camera that uses the depth motion dots, the Kinect technology that Microsoft licensed and now Apple's licensed. It uses that Kinect technology to make a 3D map of where you are and then figure out what's not you, which is background, maps everything in back of you in 3D space. So as you move your phone around you, it adjusts the set and creates a virtual set on a phone. You know, and and it's, you know, and you're going to see it not just here. You're going to see Google versions of this and other kinds of stuff. This whole virtual set stuff is just people like, it's quick. I'm like, do you realize what it's doing? You know, I mean, it's like back in the day when you had to green screen, and granted, the lines aren't the cleanest on this, but, you know, trying to green screen and create an edge that it live green screens everything out in back of you because it has a depth map. I'm just like, it's just insane. And you know, Apple came out with, you know, AR Kit, which is amazing. Google released, I think, AR Core or whatever that is, which is their tool set. We're getting Microsoft's going to have more stuff for HoloLens. The where this stuff is going is just insane, absolutely insane. So I love they pull out this app called Clips. You're like, oh, this is really cool. Like, I'm on the Millennium Falcon, or you can do it. I'm on a Star Destroyer, or I'm in this kind of Neo Tokyo looking environment. Like, I'm like, wait, like, this is amazing. So
that's great.
Yeah.
And my review on the iPhone X, which I got last week, is FaceTime is insane.
Or face, the face ID?
Recognition. Just,
oh, the Face ID.
Just crazy. I was on the plane, red eye to Philadelphia, wearing, I decided to put on sunglasses, pitch black plane, and it was unlocking my face like on the red eye. It's remarkable what it does.
That's awesome.
Yep. Yeah, it is. It's so fast and seamless. I show it to people, like, whoop, like, oh, well, let me show you Face ID. I'm like, no, that was Face ID.
Yeah, that was working. It.
Yeah, so cool. All right, we good?
We're the best
there ever was.
It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.